The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Euro 2020 final preview. We always intended to do this pod, you know, look ahead to two European giants playing in another final, probably France versus Portugal, getting out of the group of death, and here they are back again. There'd be a bit on Wales and Scotland bravely performing against the odds, and of course that bit on England knocked out again by two late Thomas Müller goals against Germany. We'd be interested, but perhaps not invested, but we're used to that. We know how to do that. Instead, we have this, England in the final. And the oddest thing about it is, it doesn't feel that odd. Italy have a glorious midfield, an experienced manager, a joyous central defence. They're good, but England are good. They could actually win. They might not, but they could. We'll look at how and why they might. We'll assess the strengths and weaknesses of both sides. You've asked lots of sensible questions, we'll ask them. You've asked lots of silly questions, we'll also ask them. England v Italy, the final of Euro 2020. This is the Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, hello.
It's coming home, I'm starting already, Max. Let's go. Good morning. Just to get in there early and piss off Baz. Good morning, everybody.
Mark Lax, apologies to those who listen with their babies, course. That's okay, Jordan. We have a strange relationship with swearing that we haven't quite worked out yet, I think it's fair to say. From the Racing Post, Mark Langdon, hello.
Hello, Max.
And Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, Max. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. So look, England in their first major final since 1966. Mark, how do you feel about it?
To be honest, Max, I'm buzzing now after sort of seeing your face. Your face has sort of lit up the Zoom for me. It's it is a special moment in sort of England's sporting history, even to reach a final. I mean, I think I was pretty calm throughout most of the tournament, and semi-final felt a bit different. I think, you know, just getting over that hurdle that had been so painful in the past. And I think that what you said there is, it, Max, in the intro, is that it actually doesn't feel that odd in some respects. The way that they've kind of grown throughout the tournament and been quite composed, Gareth Southgate has managed to kind of just keep everybody calm while there's kind of this madness around the outside. And I think if you look at it, they deserve to be in the final. So just embrace it and, you know, hope for the best in the final.
Jordan?
Yeah, same. I'm really looking forward to it. Not so much because I think it's going to be a really entertaining game. I don't think it will. I don't think it'll be a free-flowing, you know, sexy football kind of guy. I think it could be actually quite dull, boring and, you know, quite stodgy at times. But I'm looking forward to it. And to Mark's point, I think it is one of the, I think it would be the biggest achievement in this country's sporting history since 66. I know that, you know, Mo Farah's had success in the Olympics and Andy Murray, I know he's Scottish, but Andy Murray's British, has won Wimbledon and Lewis Hamilton. There's been some massive sporting moments for England / Britain over the last 50 odd years, but this would eclipse all of them for me. This would be the biggest. I think that we shouldn't underestimate how big a moment this is. And I spent a lot of time, as you have as well, Max, down at Wembley and just seeing the build-up, England game by England game, to get into this point. Again, I agree with you and Mark. It doesn't feel weird. It feels like England deserve to be there and they've got a chance. This is not England of 10 years ago where you think they've got a punt but will probably get beat. And to that point, I think the great job that Southgate has done is, whilst obviously England fans want to win this final, clearly, you don't get the sense that if England were to lose on Sunday, it would be the last time they would get to the last four, the last two. It feels like England now are a serious team that almost expect to get to the latter part of competitions rather than being a bit of a laughing stock, which for many years England national team were to the country.
Barry, you did an excellent first response on the pod on Wednesday night. It didn't make the edit.
I'm not sure why, but...
Well, I had discussions with the head of audio and we're allowed to play it at a live show. And then you walked home. Richard says, why did Barry walk the 4.7 miles home at 2 a.m.? Is he one of those people that can only go to the toilet in their own house? We've established that you don't even need a toilet sometimes. But How do you feel now?
I have a deep sense of foreboding, but having had an almost 5 mile walk home from your house the other night to gather my thoughts, I walked over Blackfriars Bridge. I'm at peace with the fact England are in the final. I think they deserve to be in it. I think they have a good chance of winning it. And that will make me sad if it happens. But I'm looking forward to it. I really am looking forward to it just as a game of football. But I'm not as horrified as I thought I would be. But, you know, it would be... I'm certainly not going to jump on the bandwagon at this point. I'm not like Boris Johnson or Priti Patel, you know.
You might as well, Barry.
I have, you know, 47 years of contempt in the bank. That's not about to change just because they're in a final. But I am at peace with it.
Okay. Let's talk about England first then. Who surprised you so far, Mark? Like what players have come to the fore that you weren't necessarily expecting to do so?
I mean, I would say Raheem Sterling. Because, I mean, he's obviously was, a very important player for Manchester City up until sort of the last few months of the season we've just had. But the way that he finished the campaign, he would not have made my starting 11. And I know that Southgate's a big fan of him. I felt it was a mistake. Going back to like Croatia, when I saw the team, I was like, I'm not saying I wanted Foden and Grealish and every one of the sort of attacking playmakers that people were calling for. But I mean, even felt like just like a Sancho or something, I'd almost given up a bit on Raheem Sterling. You know, Pep Guardiola had dropped him. And I felt it was the wrong decision to play him. Obviously, Gareth Southgate marginally knows the England players better than me. And, he's been proven absolutely right to stick with Raheem Sterling, because not just being his goals, I think his all-round play. It was maybe against Scotland wasn't fantastic, but... apart from the whole team didn't function properly that night. But apart from that, he's been absolutely integral to everything that England have done. And I would have said as well, the other one was Jordan Pickford, who I know didn't have the best of semi-finals and just seemed way too excited, really. He was just had reached over that boiling point. But up until that semi-final, and even in the semi-final, he did make one or two big saves. But he's another one I wouldn't have had in the starting 11. I felt that there were other goalkeepers that were sort of safer options, but he's conceded one goal in the tournament. It still makes me nervous, but up until this point, he surprised me.
It would be punchy now if Raheem Sterling was a make-weight in a swap deal for Harry Kane, wouldn't it? Interesting to see that. Pete says, can we have some love for John Stones? He's quietly had an outstanding tournament, especially given where he was a year ago. And that people said he only looked good because of Ruben Dias. Cue an absolute howler in the final to cost us the game. But it's a good point, Jordan, isn't it? I mean, we could go through every player, and maybe we will. I don't mind. I've got time. I'm happy to revel in it. But Stones has had a good tournament, hasn't he?
He has. And I do buy into the old adage that the best defenders are generally the ones that you don't notice. And I haven't really noticed John Stones this tournament. And I, to be fair to that texter or that tweeter's comment, was one of those people that was saying John Stones only looks good this season because Ruben Dias is next to him. And I think Stones had
a
better...
Who knew a hot take that Jordan has to wind back on?
I'll take that L. But he has just quietly gone about his business. But one thing I will also row back on, or not quite row back on, but to your previous question to Mark, I would have gone, well, my pick would have been Harry Maguire. Because I'm not a massive Harry Maguire fan. The two things that people always say about him, I think, are overinflated are his bringing out of the ball from the back and his aerial presence. I don't think he's as good in the air as people make out. I think this season I've seen him get dominated in the air a lot and also bring out the ball. This tournament, I don't think I've seen him miss a ball in the air. And he actually has brought the ball out well from the back and been punching it really well into the front men too. And that maybe also is why Stones has been playing well too, because he's got someone like a Maguire now, who actually, I'm not his biggest fan, but fair play, I think he's been brilliant. So,
are you saying John Stones only looks good because Harry
Maguire
is next?
I don't want to say that, because that's unfair. That is a bit unfair, but I think they've both in their own ways been really, really good. Stones has just been quietly consistent. I think Maguire has been loudly dominant, and I think they've both complemented each other really well in this tournament.
Evil Al says, you know how needy us Leeds fans are. I don't think any of you picked Calvin Phillips in your lineups before the tournament kicked off. I think he was seen as the most expendable. How many of you would pick him now? I mean, that's certainly true. I think even after the Scotland game, Barry, I was suggesting Henderson and Bellingham would be a better two than Rice and Phillips.
Well, funnily enough, I was going to say Calvin Phillips if you'd come to me with the question about who surprised you. I don't know if it's a huge surprise. I think it's a surprise that he is an automatic starter, considering he had never played in the Premier League or any top flight before the start of this season. He has said himself, he has acknowledged the debt he owes our old friend Marcelo Bielsa, and I think without Bielsa, he wouldn't be within an ass's roar of the England team and possibly wouldn't even be a Premier League player, just a championship, a solid championship player. But I think people were worried that Southgate's lineup was too defensive. And I think those people may not have seen a lot of Leeds, because Calvin Phillips has a wonderful passing range that can't be overstated. I didn't think he had one of his better games in the semi-final, but I am a huge admirer of his as a footballer, and he just seems like an absolutely lovely guy. But then so does everyone on that team. I wish there was someone on that team I could really hate, but there isn't.
Pete Grealish.
Nah.
The fullbacks as well, Mark. And what's interesting about the fullbacks is there's just been so much debate about, even going back to Trent Alexander-Arnold's got to be in the squad, and be fascinating to know what would have happened had he not got injured in that warm-up game. But Luke Shaw has been brilliant, and Kyle Walker, and we'll get onto what formation England should play in just a second, have both been sensational and sort of trippier whenever he's come on, or in the two games that he started. It's just so sort of reliable and dependable, and they're all great, aren't they, Mark? Look at them all.
I think Trippier has just been coached by Diego Simeone for a year. I saw when he came on the other night, he was sort of, he'd pick the ball up and throw it down to waste a few seconds, and a bit like a tennis player, wasn't happy with one ball, rolled it away. Just killing the clock. He's definitely been coached that into him. I don't remember that previously. So he's a very wise guy to have on. I mean, I think in terms of Trent, I just don't think he would have played that much at all, really, had he not got the injury, because of the quality of the fullbacks. And Kyle Walker, I thought, was probably the best player on the pitch against Denmark. And, we're talking about why John Stones has played well. I think the connection between, if you know somebody, if you're the right-sided centre-back and the person on that right plays with you sort of every week at club football, I think that has to help. So that Man City connection might be another reason why Stones had a good tournament. But yeah, I thought Kyle Walker was outstanding against Denmark. The pace that he's got, his recovery pace, is just unbelievable, really. And Luke Shaw, I think this is a great story, really, because he struggled. He had a horrendous injury. And you did wonder whether he'd ever get back to sort of the form that had made Manchester United buy him in the first place. But he was an important player for United in the season we've just had. And he's played an integral role, really, in terms of England, particularly going forward. He was part of that sort of combination against Germany that sort of ended up winning that game. And, Mourinho still has the odd pop at him now. And it's a little bit weird, but he's answering him in just a perfect way, really.
I was chatting to Jonathan Wilson yesterday about, how England should line up today. And obviously the debate before every game is a back three or a back four. And Wilson was suggesting going to a three would be really sensible in this game, playing Walker on the right of the three with Stones and Maguire, Trippier and Shaw wingbacks, and then dropping Saka and playing Mason Mount on the wide right, which I think he did in the game against Belgium in a warm-up game. So you'd have Mount, Kane and Sterling, Rice and Phillips in the midfield, Trippier right, Shaw left, Maguire, Stones and Walker. That sounds sensible. Jordan?
Yeah, it does. It does. I'd probably tend to agree with that formation. I think we've spoken a lot, and not just us, on radio stations and television programs about which formation for which game and all that sort of stuff. And I understand why. But England are in the final now. And whilst the formation and system, I think, is key, because I think Italy have a really good formation and system that we have to be able to deal with and hurt. At the end of the day, in 90 minutes or 120 minutes, the players on the pitch have to do the business. And whilst we can talk about, you know, this guy inside pocket here, this side comfortable, on the day, the guys have to step up. This is their moment to win a European Championship final. And it comes down to them. Southgate and his team, backroom team, have done the hard work in prepping them. They now have to be the guys accountable to get this England team over the line. So I really feel like we can talk about systems all day long, and we have done. But I think ultimately what's going to win England this game is dealing with the pressure and quality on the pitch when they have the ball.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jonathan makes a good point on that formation. I think my sort of gut instinct is that Southgate won't do that, and he'll the only time we've seen really the back three from the start was when he matched up against Germany's back three, and Italy don't play with a back three, so my sort of feeling is that he probably won't do that. That one position, the Saka one, is the vulnerable spot. I think we could all probably guess the sort of other 10 players that are going to play in the game against Italy. And whether it's Trippier, whether it's Saka, whether it's Sancho, Foden or Grealish, I tend to agree with Jordan. I don't think it matters too much really at this stage now. And I think Southgate has done enough for people just to earn that trust of him, and what him and Steve Holland and the rest of the coaching staff think is the right way to go. I hope there isn't this massive debate on Twitter at sort of 7 o'clock on Sunday night about, oh God, why has he done this? We've reached the semi-final, we've reached the final. I think he's earned the right to pick the team that he thinks is the best one.
Trust the process. Roberto Mancini's team are unbeaten in 33. Hadn't conceded a goal for almost 1,000 minutes before conceding to Austria in the last 16. I mean, Barry, how complete a team are they? Are they a complete team just without a brilliant centre-forward?
Yeah, I think they're a wonderful team. I mean, people talk about the spirit of the England camp. I think Italy have a similar spirit. People talk about Southgate being urbane, sophisticated, intelligent, statesman-like. I think Roberto Mancini is similar, possibly not to quite the same extent. And he also seems to have assembled a wonderful backroom team around him, like Southgate has. They're fostered this great sense of togetherness. As far as formations are concerned, I presume they'll go 4-3-3 as usual. I like Mark, think Gareth Southgate will go with probably the same team he played again in the semi-final. And I suppose it depends on who's best able to play the match and not the occasion. Will England be streetwise enough to deal with Italy? I think they will. It's hard to find a weak spot in that Italy side, just looking at the probable lineup. There seems to be some doubt over whether Federico Chiesa will play. I think he might have a knock or something. So presumably, if he was out, Berardi would come in his place. That's, I think Italians would much prefer Chiesa, but it is hard to spot a weakness. Like, Jorginho has been an absolute revelation in this tournament, arguably one of the players of the tournament. So, and then you have the wily old centre halves and Bonucci and Chiellini, who, very much a portcullis at the back there. I'm looking forward to seeing how Harry Kane in particular and England's front three in general get on against them.
I like that, Jordan said, good centre-backs are ones you don't notice. I did think I noticed Chiellini quite a lot. Sorry, Jordan, you were going to say something.
No, I was going to say, Barry picked up on Jorginho there, and I don't want to talk for Jonathan Wilson, but I'm thinking and guessing the reason why he went for the system that he predicted was because I think that if England are going to really win this game, they have to get busy around Jorginho. Jorginho, I think he lacks pace. He's not very quick, but he's very, very intentional and intelligent when he has the ball. So I think England have to keep him quiet and make him do the thing that I think he doesn't want to do, which is defend and go backwards and on the turn constantly. I think if they allow him to get on the ball and look up, I think that's going to cause England problems. I think that system allows England to really get men around Jorginho and keep at his heels.
And that's the interesting thing there, Mark, is that the person who would probably be on Jorginho would be Mason Mount, who should know about him, at least.
Yeah, and I think Mount, you know, it's one of the things he does really well, actually. His off-the-ball work is something that, Frank Lampard, they've mocked him in parts for sort of that teacher's pet stuff. But, you know, Thomas Tuchel and Gareth Southgate come to realise as well that he really is an important player, for Chelsea and for England. And he's kind of a modern-day number 10, really, isn't he? You know, these kind of luxury Ozil types have gone out of the game, really. And they're just... it's just an extension of being sort of a creative central midfielder, but he can do both parts of it, really. You know, he's somebody that probably, could just play alongside Rice or Phillips if you wanted him to. So he can do the defensive side of it. I think one of the real interesting bits of the way that Italy play is the attacking left-back, obviously Spinazzola, cruel injury for him against Belgium. Emerson did a similar job against Spain. He hit the bar, also made one really deep run that just evaded him, that the final pass there. So I think stopping him is going to be quite interesting, really. I mean, he wouldn't be the biggest name in the Italy team, but the way that Italy play, you know, that is one of their outlets, really, to push Insigne inside and then get the attacking left back motoring up the pitch. So, you know, what that does mean is it leaves space in behind, and then you go for whether it's Saka or Sancho, whoever on that right hand side can then maybe exploit that. But I totally agree that Jorginho has been important. But you can't over-focus on him because they can go to Verratti and he can sort of drop deep and then start picking the passes. What Spain did brilliantly against Italy was that they just took the ball off of Italy, and then their outstanding midfield was unable to function properly. My doubt is whether England, although they're improving in that area, they're not Spain at sort of keeping the ball, and I expect Italy to have the majority of possession, and that would worry me most. I think that England won't be able to defend against Italy the way that Spain did, because Spain defended by having the ball.
Mark, what's the sort of depth from Italy? Like, Southgate hasn't made that many changes. We know about like the scary seven, as Jack Grealish called them, but when Mancini goes to the bench, because I thought when Chiesa came off and was it Belotti came on, I thought, well, that. They're very different players, and I'm not quite sure about Belotti. I want to touch wood every time I say something that isn't totally positive about an Italian player. But is that a possible advantage for England?
I mean, I think that England's bench is stronger than Italy's, although Italy's bench has actually had an impact at this tournament. Pessina's come on and scored. Chiesa has come on and scored goals as well. And somebody like Locatelli started the tournament and now finds himself out of the 11. But I think it's in those forward positions where you're not overly concerned, I would say, on paper at least, at what Italy can bring on. Whereas I think if you go through that England bench and go Grealish, Foden, Sancho, there's massive game changers there. And Southgate's been quite slow, I think, to make his substitutions. But I think Italy, they're kind of at a level. Like if Pessina come in, no, you wouldn't be overly concerned, even though he's had an impact on the tournament. So I think England's depth is superior.
And yeah, you mentioned the benches there, guys, but I also wonder what role fitness will play in this stuff. I know Italy have had obviously a day more to prepare, but I think Southgate's use of his bench has been really smart as well. It was very noticeable in the Denmark game. The Denmark, I think, going into extra time had used all of their subs, if not, or had one left, and Southgate had only used one. And I just thought that was really, really interesting to see that going into the depths of a 120-minute game, he still wasn't looking to use up all of his bench in the way that Denmark had. And I know that we've got, I think England do have a stronger squad, and it hasn't been used as much as Italy's squad. So I just wonder, going to the final, how much fitness and fatigue may be a factor on Sunday.
You say the Italians look tired. I do you know what? Just from listening to you lot and thinking about the formation, I'm sneaking feeling that Foden might start. I don't know. I just thought he looked so good when he came on. And
in place of Saka, would that be?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I that's a bit harsh on Saka. You know, you make these sort of, you do make quick judgments because you only have, what, 7 games in a tournament, right? Or is it 7 in this one? Or
7, yeah.
You know, and I'm not used to England playing 7 games in a tournament. it's 5, isn't it? That's 5 games per tournament.
Max.
Who knows, obviously.
Well, you had a third place playoff in the last one, didn't you?
A very good point. Jay Fitz saying, am I right in thinking that the ratio of tickets for the final will be 59-1 in favour of England? Can someone try and legitimise that thinking face? 1,000 Italy fans will be allowed into the UK for the final. €610 ticket will have to fly in and out on Sunday, remain in a bubble and quarantine on return. Obviously, they remain in their bubble until they're in the ground celebrating, and then they can hug each other all they like. There presumably will be Italy expats. A lot of people will have bought tickets for the final sort of months in advance. Be interesting to see what the crowd will be. But obviously, home advantage is big, Barry.
It is, but my understanding is that there's, as well as those 1,000 Italians who are flying in their little bubble, I mean, Denmark, I think England and Denmark got 8,500 tickets each for the final officially. I presume that will be the case. There are plenty of Italians living in England and London, so they won't. It's not like they're thin on the ground. I would imagine Italy will have good support, but yeah, obviously home advantage for England is a huge thing, and yeah, England are very slight favourites. And I guess that's the home advantage. Mark would be no more about that end of things than me.
Yeah, I think it's the home advantage, Barry, because actually in terms of the other aspects of it, you know, it's such a global market now, that kind of England kind of wave of patriotic support doesn't impact the market quite like it sort of maybe did during the 90s and early 2000s. I don't quite get there's a lot of criticism, and I've seen various people go on about England's home advantage. I mean, you know, in most tournaments, somebody has home advantage. Now, maybe there might be more travelling supporters. These are different times, but yeah, somebody is at home in every World Cup and European Championship. So, England are taking advantage of that, just like Russia did in the last World Cup, and like most other teams have for, you know, just forever in sort of international tournaments.
That'll do for part one. We'll do some of your questions in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, the Premier League season is almost upon us.
You can't be serious.
Here we are, and we're doing a live show with that sort of enthusiasm on the 12th of August, 2021. That's this year. I probably don't need to tell you the year. The year we are currently in. At 7:30 p.m. on the 12th of August, it's £7 a ticket. Me, Baz, we'll work out who's going to come on the panel and all those things leading up to the Premier League season, which starts on Friday the 13th. If you are not in the country or a different time zone, or you can't join that night, the event will also be recorded, and a link to the video will be emailed to all ticket holders, and you'll be able to watch it for a week over and over and over again. If you want to find out more, go to theguardian.com/guardianlive, and I'll start scheduling tweets. Not yet, in a bit.
Oh, Max, I was just going to say, ahead of the Premier League season, I texted you to say that Ryan Bertrand to Leicester was almost certainly the transfer that would fly under your radar.
Oh, completely.
Just to get you, you know, on top of your game ahead of the 12th of August.
Who knows where J. Rodriguez is, right? An absolute shock wherever he turns up. Right, bit of admin. UEFA have opened an investigation into the conduct of England fans during the semi-final win against Denmark, the use of the laser pen, booing the anthem, and planned use of fireworks in the stadium are all on the agenda. I mean, I don't really know what we can add. I don't, like, whatever the fine is, it is not going to stop some absolute idiot taking a laser pen so he can laugh with his mates in whatever pub he's in the next day going, yeah, that was me. And you just think, just don't do that. Please don't do that. And booing the anthem is depressing, but I don't know how, and if anyone has a good... The Italy anthem is so good. Like, sing it, for goodness sake.
Anyone who boos the Italian national anthem should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves. It is, by a mile, the best national anthem in the world. Like, just head and shoulders above every other anthem.
It's so good because it's got the, you know, there's such a build-up. You know, you just go da-da-da-da-da, and you can see the player, you know, Chiellini's just getting, like, whoever's on either side of him is just sort of, like, just getting their neck basically cricked, aren't they, as he's just going... Da 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 da. Anyway, don't boo it if you're going. I suspect the Venn diagram of people who boo the anthem and who listen to this pod is probably not a lot of people within that Venn diagram. But there we are. And also, there were some, I don't know, the atmosphere. You've been at Wembley, Jordan. My experience after the Germany game is really positive and really good, and seeing England fans sort of consoling Germany fans. I've seen one or two reports of Danish fans really not being treated very well. By England fans. And I don't know if that was you were there. Like, there will always be a section, I don't want to say minority, because, you know, even if it's one, but a minority of in 60,000 could be 1,000. That's quite a lot of people if they're abusing Danish fans.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there for every England game. I've not seen any what I would call abuse of rival fans. I mean, you get a few hundred idiots in the square bit outside, and they just lob, you know, bottles and cans in the air, and beer goes everywhere. And I think they throw it across the crowd. And that obviously is so, so dangerous. And being with a camera crew and a producer in the middle of it to get the great picture is a gamble that we as journalists take. But apart from that, I think it's been in good spirit. The only thing that has, offended me that I've not liked is a couple of the English songs, which I just think are quite offensive and outdated and, dare I say it, racist, that they seem to revel in on the tube, on the way to Wembley Park and outside. But apart from that, I can't say I have seen any kind of overt abuse of other fans. But the booing of the anthem and the singing of certain songs are the only two things that I've seen that I just think, you twats.
Kate Adie there, reporting live from the war zone.
I had an expensive jacket ruined by some cheap beer. Again, I think it was a Germany game. I was well upset about that.
If you want to feel really like a war correspondent, this was a top tip to Viz, you know, for local TV reporters, which of course you are national, but to make yourself feel like a high-powered foreign correspondent, just wait 10 seconds before answering any questions. Just hold your ear and go, yes, you join me here. Now, England's win over Denmark attracted a peak viewing figure of 27.6 million people, the highest ever peak football audience for a single channel game in the UK. 27.5 million turned into defeat by Croatia. So 100,000 more people for that win. The game will be on ITV or BBC One. ITV did break their hoodoo, at least. So you have a choice. So that is nice. I had written, is there anything bad about England getting to a final? The only other thing, I talked about this on the radio yesterday, is this obsession with, and of course, other, you know, we talk about football all the time. You know, we're not just like getting a dog for Christmas and throwing it away. But obviously, you know, Good Morning Britain or, you know, TVAM, don't they? You know, Whack-A-Day, everything, every single show has to talk about the football. It's the lead story in the news. But that does lead to, you know, and we can now join our reporter, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, who I believe is with Sam Wilson, who used to go to school with Luke Shaw's sister. You know, like, it just gets increasingly tenuous. The people, you know, we have met every PE teacher. I'm just waiting for a PE teacher to just say, do you know what? I don't really remember. I don't really remember Jude Bellingham. I had 30 kids in the class. Like, he seemed all right. Oh, he was quite good at football, but...
That happened to me yesterday. I did that exact piece yesterday. We met, and she was lovely, lovely young girl who's a TikTok star. Who lives on the estate that Sterling grew up on in Wembley. And she was honest, and in the report we made it clear she hadn't actually met Raheem Sterling, but they had a lot of mutual friends.
Okay. You're the problem. Well, I saw one of your colleagues, Minnie Stevenson, had to interview Atomic Kitten. I mean, they were really, you know.
I will not have a bad word said about Atomic Kitten.
I know, they like
Liz
your voice.
From Atomic Kitten said, I have the sexiest voice she's ever heard on the radio.
Wow.
We will have no disparagement of Atomic Kitten on this podcast.
I wonder how All Saints feel. You know, and they say, God, that could have been. They were always cool at All Saints. Not being rude about Atomic Kitten, but you know, I reckon if All Saints had written like the song that everyone was singing, they'd be like, "Nah, you can sing it. We don't need this comeback. We don't need to do that."
Just what you were talking about there about journalists, you see it in newspapers as well. That you know, if England are doing really well at something, all the big boy journals who normally write about politics, they have to get involved and they wander over to the sports desk and suggest this wonderful idea they have for a column. And, you know, it's not like, you know, during the general election, Barney doesn't sidle over to the news or Jonathan Liu or Wilson or whoever and say, oh, well, I've got this, you know, 800 worder on Tory economic policy. I think, you know, you couldn't possibly live without. That would be unheard of. But it always happens the other way around.
And it's also funny, is like we spend a lot of time obviously being critical of things within the game. You know, there are lots of things wrong with the game. But as soon as big boy journalists start doing it, I'm like, oi, don't be rude about football. That's our, we can be rude about, you can't be rude about football. Like, you don't deserve the football because we are, you know, it is a bit like lower league fans when you start winning games and other fans sort of start turning up and it's a bit more of a squeeze on the terraces. And you're like, what? I don't want.
You've not paid your dues.
I don't want more fans coming, paying money through the turnstile, making our club more successful. I don't want that. I want space. I want you to know. I want you to know who John Rattle and Hackenhay Retton were. I don't want you coming in here. Yes, Mark.
No, but I mean, this is the This is what the national team is, isn't it? I think then that's one of the reasons why it's special is that, you know, my mum can ring me up and sort of, you know, start saying she wants Phil. She doesn't even call him Phil Foden. She just calls him Phil. She's like, why is Phil not in the team? And I don't know. You know, I could explain to her sort of, you know, tactically Saka maybe tracks back a little bit more, but I don't think everyone just wants to be involved. And I actually think it's one of the nicer things really about the national team that you can get people on breakfast TV that clearly, you know, don't know that much about the subject. But I mean, you know, you've got your club football, I think, for that really sort of more serious sort of chatter at times. But yeah, I like the national team kind of irreverent stories that go with it.
Well, it was illustrated really well a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? With the it was an ITV breakfast reporter outside Wembley who thought he'd met Jurgen Klopp. And it was. I don't know if it was a professional impersonator or some guy that just looked a lot like Jurgen Klopp, but he did a whole report on the fact that Jurgen Klopp was in the middle of this group of fans, pissed off his face. It's like, dude, like, this is not a good look.
I have to say, while he was rightly ridiculed, I thought the Jurgen Klopp.
It was good.
Jurgen Klopp.
It was good.
Very.
It was good.
It's every chance I'd have been gulled as well. I'm just glad it happened to someone else.
I think Barry, the clue was the fact he was on somebody's shoulder singing "Football's Coming Home." That was
in a Liverpool in his Liverpool tracksuit. I've had two good conversations. You sort of say everyone jumps on the bandwagon. Mrs. Rushton obviously went to a hotel on the night of the semi-final to just be away from it. And she asked me before the game what costume England were wearing, which I thought was a lovely a lovely phrase. John Pigeon has a question. What is the better scenario for Barry and his compatriots? Italy dominate England, win by two or three, or Italy play terribly, hang on for the whole game and win on penalties after a masterful display of shithousery throughout the game?
I would say with the benefit of hindsight, option B. But that sounds far too stressful. And I think I would much prefer option A in real time.
Simon says, can Barry play out Sunday's podcast by reciting Three Lions if England win?
No.
Okay. Matthew says, will Barry agree to get the Foden haircut if England win? I'll do it myself free of charge. brackets, I'm not a hairdresser.
I won't. And even if I did, I don't think I can do it. My hair is too curly.
Oh. Willie says, if England win, will Mark eat a platter of courgettes?
No. Okay. But if they were fried courgettes with sort of loads of mayo, you could probably get away with.
Okay. Sayings McSaying says, who's had the most royalties from this tournament? Skinner and Badil, the Lightning Seeds, the White Stripes, or Gazprom? That's a good question, isn't it? I mean, they're all doing. Yes, Jordan.
Yeah, I did see one of the questions that was sent in via Twitter, a more serious one. It was along the lines of, has this actually been? I'm sure next week you'll do an overview of the whole Euros.
Oh, we're going on holiday on Monday.
Oh, okay, maybe not then.
not together, to
add. But the question was, has this been a really, really good Euros? Or is it skewed by the fact that from an English perspective, because England are in the final / could win it, it feels like it's been a really good Euros, but actually, has it been a good... I thought it was a really interesting question. If you take the investment of being English out of it, has it been a good Euros?
As someone with no skin in the game, I think it's been outstanding Euros. I wasn't convinced it would be. I didn't like the, you know, third place in the group going through business, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it, far more than I thought I would.
Mark?
Yeah, it's the best tournament for I don't want to be too recency biased, but it's the best tournament for a good while. I don't know if it was the low expectations coming into it. You know, there was all the everyone's tired fatigue of just watching football, you know, for just feels like about sort of 15, 16 months. But I really enjoyed it. You know, there was some the group stage is always going to be a bit of a hard slog, I think, because of the fact so few teams go out. But the way it ended with that group of death, sort of, you know, all in the balance right until the end. Switzerland against France was, you know, absolutely brilliant. I thought the football in sort of Italy's last two games was, I'd put it like up there with sort of Champions League quarterfinals, semi-finals, and that's usually the absolute top football around, isn't it? And both games felt at that standard.
I can only think of a couple of stinkers of games as well. I think both involving Spain, was it?
Sweden, Slovakia
was the one. Yeah. It was a Friday afternoon, I think, or like two.
There was only like a couple, one or two dogs of games. And
yeah,
the
I think so.
Have been pretty good. And some have been fantastic.
Yeah, that night with the night of the group of death with Hungary, Germany and Portugal, France, that was a brilliant night, you know, flicking between channels, the Hungary score, the equaliser on Hungary scoring straight away again. Obviously, you had that. Did you have those two comebacks on the same day? The Spain-Croatia game, and what was the other one on that day?
Yeah, it was Switzerland. Switzerland coming back against France, and
so yeah,
even down to Sweden against Poland in the group stage when Poland needed to score another goal was absolutely magnificent way to end it. The Denmark, when they beat Russia, just the noise and emotion that came out of the stadium that night was, you know, something that you'll remember. I think you'll remember that sort of, you know, in 20 years' time when you're talking about this Euros, there's enough things to sort of, you know, to really sort of go back to and reference, you know?
Something that I thought as well, looking past the Euros, was also the fact that the World Cup in 18 months, if you look at a lot of the teams that and where they are age-wise and where they're going to peak, we should be in for a really, really good World Cup. If you look at the England team, look at the Italian team, the Spanish team, you know, Portugal, and Ronaldo might not make it to that one, but there's a lot of big footballing nations, and that's before you get to the other continents, that I think will peak with really good teams in 18 months' time. So the World Cup is looking like it could be a really good one.
And we've had some brilliant goals, you know, that Modric curler, Patrick Schick. We've had some comedy-owned goals, and we've had a tiny car. So, like, what else what else do you need, right? That'll do for part two. We'll round up any other business in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Copa America, I mean, England-Italy is a brilliant final, right? I think it is brilliant. I think people outside of England-Italy would go, ah, it's great to see England v Italy. The Copa America final is Brazil versus Argentina. I mean, I don't know how often the Copa America final is Brazil versus Argentina. Obviously, Lionel Messi, the chance for him to win a title with Argentina is absolutely huge. It's on at 1 a.m. on Sunday. So you could stay up late and watch that. sleep all day, and then get up and watch England v Italy. That's like a perfect weekend. Brazil trying to win their second consecutive Copa America. Argentina looking for their first one since 1993. Sort of baffling of a country of sort of that quality to have not won the Copa America in so long. I don't know, Mark, if you've watched any of it. I've seen one brilliant Papu Gomez goal and a weird camera angle of a replay. And that is it. I don't know, Mark, if you've had any brain space to follow it.
No, I've sort of been tuning into the highlights sort of a morning just to make sure I haven't missed anything sort of too dramatic. But yeah, that camera angle did make you feel a bit sick. It was like being on a really rocky ferry that you're referencing. But that was a fantastic goal from Lautaro Martinez. He set up by Messi. It was a fine ball as well by Lo Celso. I really want Argentina to win this final. I feel like, for Messi to... He's won, obviously, he won an under-20 World Cup, won the Olympics, but at senior level, to have never won a title with Argentina. And there was, at times, there's been sort of accusations that he cares more about Barcelona than Argentina. And there was even this bit of, is he really... Argentinian, he brought up in Spain and that kind of stuff. I think in more recent years, he's been absolutely desperate to win a trophy with Argentina. Of course, come so close in terms of the World Cup, they reached the final. Higuain missed a chance he should have scored, and maybe they would have won that World Cup against Germany. That they've lost, I think it's the last four finals that they've. In terms of the Copa, which is why I just haven't been able to get over the line. Three of those defeats on penalties. It's just been heartbreak after heartbreak, really, for Argentina, and particularly for Messi. He's so determined, and I just hope that they do it. And Emi Martinez, the Aston Villa goalkeeper, he sort of shot to fame in the semi-final for...
Oh, man, it was... The chat he was giving the Colombian penalty takers was extraordinary, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was sort of right out of the Aussie sort of cricket team, I think, in terms of sort of sledging back in maybe a bygone era. He did what he had to do, I think, in his mind. But, Yerry Mina particularly received about a minute's worth of abuse before he missed his penalty. But... despite that, I don't think that's a great look, but despite that, I really hope Argentina win. I feel like Messi deserves one. I know he's won a lot, but he just deserves one with Argentina.
A few messages and emails. Greg says, can we get a shout out to the poor guy or girl who has to edit these midnight podcasts so they're ready for our consumption first thing in the morning? You heroes get all the credit, but I'm guessing it's not Baz editing the pod for hours afterwards. Yes, we should, for the record, thank Ian, Silas, Sammy and Joel, who have to stay up after we all go, aren't we brave for staying up till midnight? They've done a wonderful job.
But come on now, we are the heroes because we're here night after night. They sort of alternate, so they're sort of only doing one every four.
And it's their job.
It is their job. But look, we're allowed to give thanks, aren't we? And they've probably edited out a bit of Barry when he's had a couple too many glasses of wine to make him sound more erudite.
Glass houses, Max. You had a nice view on during the semi-final.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely did. David says, Max, Barry and co, long-time listener to Football Weekly. I want to thank you for the podcast, providing plenty of entertainment over the last few weeks during the Euros. I'm probably the only Gateshead-born person who was supporting Denmark last night for long and complicated reasons I won't bore you with, so I'm feeling slightly morose this morning. Forget the match, however. The most revelatory thing to come out of Football Weekly this week was the startling claim from Barry that he'd never been to the Rushden residence. I find this difficult to believe, almost impossible. I've always envisaged Messrs. Glendenning and Rushden living in a Morecambe and Wise style existence, sharing a bed in a purely platonic manner, eating cereal and toast together in your stripy pyjamas at the breakfast table, etc. Whilst told of the, quote, current Mrs. Rushden, I imagine she was a rather silent, unseen character like Mrs. Mannering. However, Mr. G's comment this week has shattered this image. This realization has caused me to reconsider the universe, only exacerbated by Denmark being knocked out of the semi-final. My world has been rocked, says David. Would you like to live together, Barry?
No.
Okay.
Although I do, with the benefit of hindsight, wish I'd stayed over on Thursday night.
I love the message that you sent, 11 in the morning, saying, my head hurts. my feet hurt. Kevin says, dear Best Pod, whether it wins awards or not, with the recent listener confessional pertaining to Barry's Munich plight, I could no longer listen by without sharing my own release. Mine occurred following burger night at a Tim Martin establishment in nearby Sheffield, a preparation for that evening's Football Ramble Live at City Hall, having missed out on Football Weekly Live events earlier that year. The 15-minute walk in between said establishments and subsequent queue outside played out as normal on a pre-COVID evening in October 2019, all except my insides, which by the time I'd reached the queue, I'd found myself inadvertently playing out my best John Wayne walk. It had already happened. Long story short and lesson learned, I have never listened to the Football Ramble ever again. Thank you for your superb Euros coverage. More pods at Max's house with Barry's wine pouring in the background, please. Kind regards, Kevin. And finally, a really lovely message from Sam. To get that image out of your mind. Sam sent an email. It's a really beautiful email. It's a really emotional one. He says, hi, Max and Barry. I'm one of those football fans who listen to your podcasts more than I watch games. But when I do watch games, it's as much for the communal celebration or commiseration as the sport. On Wednesday night, I should have been throwing mid-strength craft ale over my head with a group of 30-odd mates in Bristol. Instead, we all spent at our houses mourning the loss of one of our number that very afternoon. Nabil Haq, one of the funniest, most acerbic and warm men you're ever likely to meet, died hours before the match. Sorry. Hours before the match after a long battle with leukemia and then COVID, leaving his wife, Nick, and two young kids behind. I'll tell you why. It really echoes this. Sorry. With me. Let me read it. Let me control myself. While most of the country lost their collective minds in the joy of England's win, we were sharing photos and stories, laughing at his antics, crying at his passing. The last 18 months of brutal chemo and radio treatments, extended hospital stays, hopeful recoveries and gut-wrenching setbacks would have defeated me, but Nabs retained his dignity, generosity and humour to the end. Maybe his 3 decades supporting Spurs helped. Sorry. Today, Friday, we'll be attending his funeral. On Saturday, we'll be gathering to celebrate his life. On Sunday, many of us will be coming together to watch the final and raise a glass to our great friend. Whatever the outcome, there'll be tears. But if this England team have proven anything over the past few years, it's that the scoreline isn't the most important thing. It's community. That said, I hope we win. Nabs would have found the idea of a Spurs player lifting the Nabs says he would have found the idea of a Spurs player lifting the cup hilarious. Thanks for all your work, Barney's surrealism, Philippe's rants, Nicky's calm, Jonathan's rambles, and your bickering have brought much light relief to what's been a heavy couple of years, Sam. Yeah, look, thank you, Sam, for that. Very similar for me is that we lost a really great mate a few months ago, and we're all meeting up tomorrow, as it happens. I didn't think I would break during that email, but we send our love to you and to Nab's family as well. And to my mate Will and his family, because, you know, as you say, the football doesn't really matter at the end of the day. Sorry for losing that, Barry. So it's only the second time I've burst into tears this month.
No, I know you've had a tough time recently. You've hid as well, but yeah,
I was a hero. A hero.
Yes, you were a hero, and our commiserations, obviously, to Nabs's family and friends.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, thanks for the email. We really do appreciate it.
The idea of a Spurs player lifting a trophy is hilarious.
I did have this thought that Harry Kane would lift the trophy and think, that's okay, I've won this now. I don't need to win anymore. I can stay at Spur. I'm happy to stay now, you know, forgetting he's an elite sportsman and that he will want more of it. is the almost certain answer, isn't it? Look, we'll get on to whether he stays or goes and all that. I mean, let's just worry about that another time. We'll be back on Sunday night recording again at my house. We may not be sober. The difference is, Barry, I think Mrs. Rushton is staying and I have to get up at 6 a.m. to get a train on holiday the next day. So we better
have a quiet one then.
Yeah, or we'll just send you home when it finishes.
Could you get some decent wine in, though? I brought 2 nice bottles the other night. Yours was horrible.
Absolute. I just disagree completely that my one was just so much nicer than yours, and that's the thing is, it's different tastes, isn't it? And yours was, I mean, I don't know. Mine was £11 a bottle. Am I winning or losing?
Mine was $12.99.
Oh, okay. There we are. Anyway, from brutal emotion to picking over two bottles of red wine.
Wine one-upmanship.
As if you have a palate for any alcohol, Barry. It could have been Terps, couldn't it? Thank you, Mark. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Jordan.
Cheers, pal.
Cheers, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Sunday night.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.